Welcome to the Healing Pain Podcast with Dr. Joe Tata. Each week, we interview top experts in physical therapy, pain science, and integrative pain care. You'll learn the most up-to-date information for treating and reversing persistent pain. This podcast is for educational purposes only and not intended to be used as personalized medical advice. And now, here's your host, Dr. Joe Tata.
When people are faced with long-term chronic pain and the challenges it often brings, it can be easy to lose track of what's important. And chronic pain has a way of keeping people stuck in a rut. Even when people make a strong commitment to care for their pain and find a solution, the real world sometimes has a way of driving a wedge between you, your pain, and a deeper, more meaningful life. And when this happens, instead of moving toward one's life goals and purpose, people feel completely stagnant. They just feel stuck. And this is where the feelings of hopelessness and helplessness begin to set in. But there are ways that people can figure out not only why they're stuck, but also how they can get motivated and excited again about living life. Here to talk to us about psychological strategies for getting unstuck and finding pain relief is Dr. Diana Hill. Diana is a clinical psychologist, a fellow podcaster, and an expert in acceptance and commitment therapy, which is a cutting-edge evidence-based therapy that helps people develop psychological flexibility. On today's episode, we discuss daily habits you can begin to help you get unstuck from both physical and emotional pain. Diana also has a great new book. It's called The ACT Daily Journal. Make sure you take a moment to check that out on Amazon. Okay, let's learn more about psychological strategies to get unstuck and find pain relief with Dr. Diana Hill. Hi there, Diana. Thanks for joining me today on today's podcast.
Thanks, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm always excited to speak with practitioners who not only have written their own resources on ACT and the ACT model, but people who live the ACT model, because I think you really have to live the ACT model to be able to use it in practice and, of course, write a book on it. We'll talk about your book later, which is called The ACT Daily Journal. But I think a good question to start off with is, as a psychologist, you've studied lots of different methods and techniques and approaches to help people both with, you know, their physical as well as their emotional pain. Why is it that the ACT model stuck for you so much, I guess, both personally as well as professionally?
Yeah, well, I actually came to ACT. My journey to ACT was in graduate school, and I was in a very cognitive behavioral program. I was studying eating disorders at the time, and I found my way to ACT actually through DBT, which is another acceptance-based approach. I had a long background in my own mindfulness practice. I had studied with Thich Nhat Hanh at Plum Village and had my own yoga practice. And when I got to this cognitive behavioral model, I actually felt very boxed in. There was a lot of benefits to an evidence-based approach, and I really believe in the science of psychology, but I needed a little bit more room to move. And also finding in my own life this component of acceptance-based approaches that incorporate more of these Eastern principles of acceptance with the Western science was really where I got interested. So for me, over time, ACT has evolved. In the beginning, it was using ACT in an outpatient setting where I ran a treatment center for eating disorders. But really now I see ACT as less about symptoms and diagnoses and more about how to live more fully, whether you are a parent, whether you are a leader in the workplace, whether you're a practitioner helping patients, that psychological flexibility at its core is really about being able to optimally function and flourish in your daily life.
Great entrance. The idea of being boxed in speaks to me specifically, because one of the reasons why I gravitated toward ACT was earlier I studied what are called pain education approaches. So pain education approaches are used to help people what's termed as reconceptualize pain away from just something wrong with their body to there being other factors, psychological factors specifically. These pain education approaches really grew out of traditional CBT, and they focus on changing people's thoughts and beliefs about physical pain, about their body, about the cause of their pain, et cetera, et cetera. And there's some really good research that it helps with things like pain catastrophizing and kinesiophobia, which is basically fear of movement. But as a professional, I felt really boxed into it because I realized, hey, this works really well with like a certain type of patient. Like I think a high school biologist I had as a patient, once a biology teacher who had chronic low back pain, worked really well with him because he understood some way about the function of the human body. But with other people, they were looking for something that was a little, you know, looser, flexible, something that was moldable. Is that similar to what you say when you say you felt boxed in?
Sure. Well, I felt boxed in by first just the protocols that are often generated in research settings. Then you get into the real world with a patient or a client, and they're coming in with a whole lot of slew of things, right? It's not just their pain, but it's also how their stress is impacting their pain, or how experiences in the workplace are impacting their pain, right? It's a whole slew of things. And ACT is really a contextual behavioral psychology. So the contextual part matters in the sense that the context that we're in influence our behaviors. It's much more holistic of a model than just really this one kind of narrowed in symptom that we're targeting. But I think what's interesting about ACT is that it's really about how humans function. And the interesting about pain is that very similar areas of the brain are activated when we are in physical pain or when we are in emotional pain. And it's the somatosensory cortex, right? This arcuate nucleus. The same areas of our brain are activated. And our response to emotional pain and our response to physical pain is very similar. We have a way of responding to pain, which is evolutionarily, you know, what made us survive. We are the ancestors of people that ran from painful things. That's how we got here, right? And we have that in our bodies. But our response to pain is, whether it's emotional pain or physical pain, is to try and control it. And we try and control it in a lot of different ways. Either we control it by trying to control it mentally, like we get caught up in our thoughts about pain, or we actually can often really narrow down our lives to control our pain. So I've worked with clients, you know, someone with something like body dysmorphic disorder. So they have a lot of pain around the way that they view their face or their body, and they don't leave their house. That's a very narrowed, you know, way to live. But you could see the same with a chronic pain patient. And how the research is panning out at this point, the United Kingdom's NICE guidelines, which are really kind of dictate a lot of healthcare in Europe, right? Which then spreads eventually down to here we are in the US, have now said that ACT is a recommended treatment for chronic pain. ACT is also a recommended treatment for trauma. So what is the reason behind that is because underneath it is our attempts to control pain, our attempts to suppress our thoughts actually have this paradoxical effect that leads to them coming back stronger and also leads to a narrowing of our lives. So ACT is about these six core processes. I like to think of them or talk about them when I'm talking with clients, it's sort of like a Rubik's cube. Mm-hmm. Sides of a Rubik's cube. There's six sides to a cube. And sometimes we'll just focus on one side. Maybe we'll just be focusing on values, or maybe we're focusing on cognitive diffusion, stepping back from your thoughts. But all together, these six sides of the Rubik's cube really help you when you work on them, help you live more fully, help you open up your life and move towards what matters to you, even with pain, even with trauma, even with obsessive thoughts, that we can still continue to have a full and meaningful life.
I like that visual of the Rubik's cube. That's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's good. Cause you look at the ACT model, it's very flat, so to speak, the hexaflex, but mm-hmm. that Rubik's cube is almost something you can grab. You can twist it around, see different parts of it. Sometimes if you're looking at just the front side, you may be focused on maybe one or two processes, but the other four are always working in the back.
And as a practitioner, it's good to keep that in mind. That you're always kind of looking at, and maybe it'd be helpful for those that aren't familiar with the six core processes of ACT. I'll just lay them out and we can go in more deeply. But it's helpful to keep in mind as a practitioner, these six processes, because you're on the lookout for where is my client or patient stuck. So the first process is about thoughts, and it's the process in ACT is called cognitive diffusion. Sometimes if I'm working with a pain patient, I could imagine you have some thoughts about your pain written across your hand. Like, I don't have enough energy. I feel too bad to do this thing. The pain is too much to handle, right? So then you'd hold those thoughts really close up to your face like this. And then how well can you move about your life, right? How well can you read to your kid or see your partner when you're this close to your thoughts? With cognitive diffusion, we step back from our thoughts. We get a little space from them. It's almost like moving your hand away from your face so that you can take a look at your thought and see if it's helpful to you or not. But then you can also engage with the world. Mm-hmm. And what's different with that, so this one side of the Rubik's cube, is that we're not writing a different thought on your hand. We're not tying your hand behind your back, right? We're just getting space from it. So one side of that Rubik's cube is how we respond to thoughts, and thoughts with pain we can get really entangled in them, and they can be very convincing, and they can push us around and really bully us in our lives. But then the other five, I'll just list them, are values, what you care about, acceptance, being able to open up and allow for discomfort. There's perspective taking, be able to step out and look at a bigger picture, bigger view, seeing ourselves as, you know, having a transcendent self that moves across time. There's mindfulness, or being present. And I would say ACT takes a little bit of a different approach to mindfulness, that it's really about being mindful where it matters. And then there's committed action, which is taking small, tiny, behaviorally based moves towards what you care about. And those are the six sides of the Rubik's Cube. As a practitioner, you're looking for where are people stuck. And then where you're stuck is the side that you may go to and tinker with. But the key, I would say, is that we're not trying to get to a perfect Rubik's Cube. Because if I have young kids, when you solve a Rubik's Cube, it just sits on your counter. And now you're like, no one touched the Rubik's Cube. It's perfect. But rather, it's a tinkering. It's a moving. It's a flexibility. It's that we all get caught up in our thoughts. We all move away from our values over the course of our day. You know, we're like instruments that get out of tune. And really with ACT, it's about the flexibility to return over and over and over again to these six core processes, and being able to see them in yourself and see them in your clients, so that then you can use the skills and apply them in your life.
Two of those six processes you mentioned have a lot of research behind them with regard to helping people with chronic pain. And they are acceptance and values. And I was flipping through your book, The ACT Daily Journal, and you have a really nice way to describe acceptance. And you describe it from the context of living courageously. And that word, just courage, and, you know, courageous, like kind of leapt off the page and kind of like, you know, hit me square in the face. And I'm like, that's a really beautiful way to describe acceptance. Because I think there's a lot of, we are asking patients with obviously physical and mental health, it's all the same after a while, right? To do very courageous things. How did you come about that courageous kind of stance that you have there?
You know, I think we've, as Debbie Sorensen is my co-author, we're mothers and we're therapists. And I think we've been moved by our clients who have these touching moments where they've lived so courageously, and to be able to witness that and be part of it. And I think any practitioner knows that, like you feel this sense of, wow, that was such a big move for you. And I can see how hard it was. And sometimes the moves that are so hard, like I had a client once who used to have panic attacks in Trader Joe's. I personally think of Trader Joe's as a happy place. You wear like Hawaiian shirts and they always acknowledge you as a person. For this client, walking into Trader Joe's was terrifying. To go get her groceries, right? So I celebrated in the courageous move of her going in and buying some groceries for herself, right? Getting her Chinese chicken salad. And I think that when we start to frame acceptance in the realm of courageous, or in the realm of willingness, or the realm of curiosity, and there's some good neuroscience around curiosity now. I interviewed Judd Brewer, who studies cravings and addictions, and taking a curious stance towards your craving actually changes your brain, how it shows up in your brain. Those words are much more accessible, I think, to folks than the word acceptance. Because if you start off your session of like, okay, I'm practicing ACT and I'm just going to get my client to, or my patient to accept their pain, I will guarantee you will get either pushback, resistance, or you will get somebody that feels belittled. Because we don't want to make the statement of your pain isn't painful mm-hmm. or isn't excruciating or hasn't, like, there's reasons why you have hunkered down around this thing and got so caught in it. Words like courageous, willing, open, curious have a lot more, I think, movement to them in the treatment room.
So then the question I always ask myself as I, you know, watch new professionals, specifically physical therapists, who are just learning about kind of these third wave type therapies and what they really mean and what's really happening. Does it take equal amount of courage for a practitioner to adopt a new model like this, where maybe they've studied a traditional cognitive model before and they were very focused on symptom reduction? Like CBT, traditional CBT for chronic pain is primarily focused at symptom reduction, similar to those pain education approaches I mentioned earlier. How much courage does it take for a professional to really say, huh, it's really different for me to take this perspective and help someone become resilient with what they have and who they are, instead of changing what they have and who they are?
It's a tremendous amount of courage, because not only do you have to be psychologically flexible as a provider, right? You're going to get pushback. I mean, people, it's like when people come into therapy with me, the most common three questions I have or requests I have is, help me stop feeling this, help me stop thinking this, and help me stop remembering this. Mm-hmm. And as an ACT therapist, I have to respond with, I can't do that. That's right. I'm not that type of therapist. That's not what I do. Right. And actually, your attempts to not think, your attempts to not feel, your attempts to not remember are what are keeping you in what we call in the book in the experiential avoidance roundabout. Mm-hmm. And I use the word roundabout intentionally because I live in Santa Barbara, California. And I don't know, 10 years ago, they just started plopping roundabouts in to like deal with traffic. And they're actually a very effective way to deal with traffic. But if you put that in, Californians are traditionally terrible drivers. If you get a Californian in a roundabout. And what we do is we go around and around and around. So you can think about your struggle with your pain or your struggle with your anxiety or struggle with your thoughts, right? We feel caught. And how do you get out of a roundabout? You have to move over a lane and you got to exit the thing. And it's incredibly scary, uncomfortable, nerve-wracking, you know, all the things, if this is the first time in your roundabout to do that, that is what we're asking our patients to do. And that is what we're asking ourselves to do when we're entering into a new protocol or treatment program or do something that's a little out of the box, is to exit this roundabout of familiarity and comfort. But here's the deal about roundabouts. Once you exit, then you can go on any street you want in town. Mm-hmm. And you have freedom. And so I think that what I really focus on when I train a lot of practitioners, right? And so when I'm working with a supervisee, what I focus on is that feeling actually that is linked to their values of being an effective provider. And we have this is where the science part of ACT is helpful. We have the science to back it up. We don't have the science to show that ACT is better than CBT for chronic pain. ACT is equivalent when they look at systematic, you know, randomized controlled trials and reviews, it's about equivalent. But what we do see with ACT studies is that in comparison to CBT, there's a bit more acceptability to it, and both therapist acceptability and client acceptability, because ACT will help you not only get a little bit more wiggle room with your pain, it'll help you, it'll show up, have spillover effects into all sorts of domains of your life. And I am interested in that. I believe in values rich living, where how I live as a therapist. I mean, right now you'll see I'm sitting on the ground. I'm sitting on the ground because I'm taking care of my body. I follow a biomechanist named Katie Bowman. I sit on the ground because I take care of my body. I have scoliosis in my spine. I have chronic pain in my spine. And so for me, sitting on a couch or a chair is really painful. So I take care of my body when I'm doing a podcast. And that for me as a practitioner, I'm thinking about how can I do practices where I'm embodying and living out ACT while I'm helping my clients do it as well.
In that values living, there's action people have to take. So the little steps along the way. I've always, most people have taught ACT who teach actors like, okay, these are the little steps, the building blocks, little rocks along the path. And again, in your book, Committed Action, you have falling on purpose. And again, this just, you know, as a physical therapist, just rings so true because so much of what we do is physical, and the falling nature just kind of stuck with me again. So falling on purpose. So it's this, you know, to me, it's this idea that we're going to help you cultivate these skills, help you connect to values-based living. But that road may be a little bit bumpy along the way.
Yeah. Well, I was looking for my books. I wanted to read the little story around falling on purpose. I'm just going to grab it real quick, Colette, because in our book, we start out, so it's an 8-week program, and each week is dedicated to one of the 6 core processes, each of those sides of the Rubik's Cube. And then we also include a chapter on self-compassion to sort of start the whole thing off, right? Like compassion is the rich soil in which we plant these seeds of psychological flexibility. But we share little vignettes in the book. And I wanted to, maybe I could read the one about falling on purpose, because I think it's, so this is what I wrote. I've always been afraid of falling. And as a kid, I wouldn't climb trees and never made it past the bunny slope skiing. In yoga, I conveniently step out to use the bathroom when it's time for headstands. Then I learned that falling is part of committed action. In an ACT workshop, Kelly Wilson stood wobbling in a yoga tree pose and said, "What if falling were part of the pose?" Falling on purpose was radically freeing for me. If I fell on purpose, it meant I could try all sorts of things, surfing, a podcast, homeschooling, starting new friendships. Today, committing to falling on purpose opens my life to fresh opportunities. And that's where I feel like a lot of times when we get goal-oriented as opposed to process-based, ACT is a process-based approach, which means we're not actually trying to get like to that perfect Rubik's cube. We're just enjoying the process of tinkering with the cube, right? So that means when we engage in taking these steps outside of our comfort zone, we're strengthening our ability to move outside of our comfort zone, but we're also kind of holding it lightly, mm-hmm. you know, that we don't have to take everything so seriously, even our own, you know, recoveries from chronic pain. Falling on purpose frees you up. And we still use the science of committed action or the science of behaviorism and ACT. One of the things that I teach on, I teach through Instagram as sort of imagery and also through my blog. And some of the things that I've been teaching on more recently is concepts of how to set up a habit cycle. So a habit cycle in behaviorism is there's a cue, there's a behavior, there's a reward. So if you're looking at a habit cycle with something like chronic pain, the cue may be, I feel pain in my body. The behavior may be I go back to bed, you know, if I have back pain, I stay in bed. And then the reward is I feel short-term relief from that pain. But we see those habit loops and those behavior cycles of actually just keeping us in that roundabout, right? So I'm interested in setting up habit loops that are linked to values-rich behaviors. So the cue may be I feel pain in my back. And then the behavior would be, okay, how do I actually want to be today? What is important to me about my relationships or about my work? How do I want to be in relationship to my kids or my career? Then we engage in that behavior and the reward is one that is intrinsic. It's a deeper reward that is longer lasting when you're aligned with how you want to be in the world. So that's where we start to look at behaviorism and this committed action component of falling on purpose, but you're falling on purpose because you're falling towards what you care about.
You've started to touch on this already. So you're talking a little bit about psychological flexibility and kind of what it looks like. Can you give us some examples of what psychological flexibility has looked like in some of your patients as you've seen them start to grow with this model that you're teaching them?
Sure. And I, you know, when I talk about, due to confidentiality, when I talk about patients, I disguise them and kind of combine them into some new version of them. So just to honor that, that's an important part of my work. But, you know, I can think about, you know, a patient, combined patient of mine that had a lot of social anxiety. And when you have social anxiety, you feel like there's a spotlight on you, right? You feel like everyone's paying attention to all the details of your mind, right? And that social anxiety, their particular roundabout around the social anxiety is that they would never actually put themselves out there. So they wouldn't go, this was actually a therapist. So they wouldn't ever want to go and do like a group practice or go to any of the team meetings. And so they really kept their lives narrow. But when we got in touch with what are the deeper values of how they want to be as a therapist, why being a therapist was important to them. And then we took these little tiny mini moves. They were able to move into areas of discomfort, even with that anxiety there. And sure, panic attacks still showed up every once in a while. And when you experience anxiety, it's this like horrible feeling inside of your body, but turning towards that feeling, like, where is it? If it had a shape, you can do this with pain too. If it had a shape, what would the shape be? How is it moving? Is it moving up or down? Is it heavy? Is it prickly, right? Turning towards with curiosity, opening up and allowing for that sensation to be there while still moving your body in the direction of what you care about. And when you do that, you start to see people's lives open up. The anxiety doesn't necessarily go away. It might go away. That's a great side effect, but that's not the goal.
I'm so happy you brought a practitioner story into the mix. In my experience, I believe a lot of professionals come into ACT. They love it. They're excited by it. They embrace it. And they have a lot of anxiety about starting the change, like their change, obviously, changing the type of practitioner or changing their approach, changing their stance, changing the things that they agree to do with their patients, so to speak. And as you mentioned earlier in the podcast, I have no control over your pain necessarily. I can help you cope with it. I can teach you techniques in different ways, but ultimately that's not the type of work that we're doing together. So I think how it looks like to us as professionals, it's actually in line with what, if you'd ask most professionals, what do you, why did you become a psychologist? Why did you become a physical therapist? Well, I want to help people. I want to make their life better. I want to help them return back to living. All of that is really embedded in the model and the book that you're talking about, right?
Yeah. And I would actually say the fuller life that you have, the more likely you're going to experience pain. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a parent or as a pet owner, right? You know that, like, this is part of living fully, that pain and values, what Debbie and I say, they're joined at the hip. They come together. And actually, if you think about anything in your life that you've gone for, that's been really important to you, like not a bowling game that you lose, like when you like apply for something or put yourself out there in a way, or a relationship, you're pursuing a relationship that you're really kind of uncertain about, but you really like that person. It's painful. And it's actually the size of our life is dependent on the size of our willingness. Bigger willingness, bigger life. And that can be psychological pain or physical pain. So it's changing our relationship and our perspective around it. And what's hard is that because the human mind is so designed to avoid pain for evolutionary reasons and to seek out sort of hedonic pleasure, we're kind of also just working against our biology here. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of retraining. And that's, it's a process. It's a process over and over again. You know, some of the strategies are subtle that we engage in when we're experientially avoiding. I mean, some of them are obvious, like I feel lonely or stressed at night, so I drink alcohol, right? You know, you can see that would be an obvious one, numbing out with substances. But some are more subtle, and it's the subtle ones that are kind of interesting, I think, in particular with chronic pain. So things like bracing or tensing around painful spots. Mm-hmm. I know I do that for myself around my back pain, is that, or when I'm practicing yoga, if I have some discomfort, I'll like put one shoulder up, you know, to like brace against the back. And it has this cumulative effect over time, the bracing with our bodies, the holding of our breath. I mean, how important it is in our pain work to be able to breathe. I'm a yoga practitioner, so I really believe in the breath and the power of breath from the inside out for so many, has so many different benefits for us psychologically, physically, spiritually. So the we hold our breath. Or maybe we avoid pain. Here's another one that people don't see a lot that I've gotten really interested in. We avoid pain by pushing through and striving. We overwork. We do more. We accomplish more. We rush through. We speed up really quickly through things. And actually that, as you know, like you move through something really quickly, you're more likely to get yourself injured. But you're moving through it because you don't want to feel the pain of it, right? Whether that's physical again or psychological, these are just sort of mirrored with each other in the physical and psychological realm. So working with your patients, it can be really helpful. And we make a list in our book of some of these common emotional avoidance strategies, is to help them start to see, wow, when I do this, short term, I get relief. But long term, what are the consequences for me? Either consequences that are negative, like for me physically, or consequences that are not helpful and that I don't end up moving towards that free roam of the streets that I want to have in my life.
What can someone begin to do today or this week to help them move toward their values, their personally chosen values?
I think there's different avenues into your values. So one avenue in, and I actually think about this with clients a lot, is through looking at where you feel energized and lit up. And where you feel that sense of almost like flow in your life, or you feel that sense of longing in the heart space. So when I'm working with clients, I'll pay attention to when they're talking about things. And if you're working with a pain client, pay attention to when they're talking about their pain. Don't pay attention to the pain part. Pay attention to when they're talking about like the parts that they miss, right? And that can be an avenue in of like, What is it that energizes them, but also where is the loss? And often the loss is things like around relationships or around, you know, I used to have a client that I've worked with for years that loves to hike, and knee pain has gotten in the way of that, right? And so we work on like, what if you were to go there and just be in the nature? You know, you don't have to, like, it doesn't have to be a hike. It can be like you go and you get out of the car and you start by sitting by the stream that's right at the trailhead, you know? So looking for both sides of it, look for where people feel energized, be a highlighter for that, but also look for where people feel loss, where people feel longing, where people feel that they're like their lives have gotten narrow, because that can often be an arrow that's pointing towards values. So once you get that going, you start to highlight it. You start to use that as sort of the rich material to help motivate people. That's the motivation of the why behind why we're doing this work. And there's actually, I was going to say, there's a couple of resources of just really simple questionnaires that you could use to help with this. There's the, I have it right here, the Chronic Pain Values Inventory. It's by McCracken. And it's just a really simple one where people look at different domains like family, intimate relationships, friends, work, and health. And they rate how important those domains are to them. And then they rate the degree to which they feel like they're successful in living out their values in those domains. And you start to look at this discrepancy, like here's this domain that's really important to me, but I really feel like I'm not living out my values in it. And that can get a conversation going about what is it that maybe we want to be more willing or courageous around so that we can get a little bit more aligned with how we want to be in the world.
When you write a book on ACT, things start to change, I think, both for yourself and for the people who pick up your book and start to read it and discover ACT and your approach to it. How has the ACT Daily Journal changed your life?
Well, Debbie and I wrote a book about psychological flexibility as parents during a pandemic. So yeah, we started with, okay, we got to start with compassion. That's going to be our first chapter. And we were very much, let's try this on while we are doing it. You know, writing with her actually taught me a lot about interconnection and community and friendship. I've been a very solo, I'm a solo player. I ran cross country. I like have my private practice. Working in groups, this is uncomfortable for me. Striving is my emotional avoidance strategy. And so working with Debbie during this time really taught me about this compassion that's needed. And I do believe that compassion, the ability to be present with ourselves and with others in the face of suffering and the desire to alleviate suffering, is at the foundation of this work. I learned about that in a very intimate way, that I cannot do everything that I want to do all the time. And I have to prioritize based on my values. And sometimes that's sharing the load and saying, hey, Debbie, I can't do it all this week. Can you take the edits? It takes a lot of humility to recognize our limits and also to do some boundary setting. So I guess ACT Daily Journal taught me about that. And then my favorite part was the last chapter. We talked about integration. And I'm a beekeeper. I'm a homesteader. So I love bees, and I love what bees have to teach us about working together for a greater whole. That ultimately this work isn't just about me or about the client or the patient that I'm in the room with, but this spreads. So when I work on psychological flexibility with this person, or even in this interview, having this conversation with you, Joe, it's going to spread to others that are listening. And then those that are listening will spread it to others that are listening. And then all of a sudden, we're starting to spread something that's good. And we are as a species interconnected. And if you are living well and you are flourishing in your life, it feeds back to me and it feeds back to all of us. And I think we have a lot to learn from other species, other animals like bees, pro-social species like bees, about that.
I've been speaking with Dr. Diana Hill. She is an ACT-trained licensed psychologist. You can check out her book. It's called The ACT Daily Journal. It's available online. You can find it on Amazon. Diana, thanks so much for being here with us this week and talking about ACT and all the great work that you're doing. Share with us how we can follow you and learn more about your work.
Sure. As I mentioned, I do some teachings through Instagram. If you're a social media person and you want to see some pictures of my beekeeping, you can go there. I teach ACT there. I also offer a lot of ACT workshops and trainings for both professionals and lay people. And you can find those through my website at drdianahill.com. I also offer a free Tuesday teaching where I incorporate movement, ACT, and meditation into my teachings. And that you can find that on my website as well. And then finally, for folks that want to learn more of the body-based how I incorporate these ACT principles into like body-based practices, which I'm really interested in. If you go to my website and you sign up for the 6 strategies for body-based practice, practicing ACT with your body, that would be a great way to learn that skill.
Excellent. So make sure you check out her website. It's pretty easy. Dr. Diana Hill, that's drdianahill.com. And of course, make sure to check out her book and share this episode with your friends and family. So grab that link and share it in Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter. If you're on Instagram, tag me. My handle is really easy. It's at drjoetata.com, and I'll be sure to tag you back. Okay, make sure to stay tuned to the Integrated Pain Science Institute and the Healing Pain Podcast, and we'll see you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Healing Pain Podcast with Dr. Joe Tata. To subscribe to the podcast and learn more, visit integrativepainscienceinstitute.com. That's integrativepainscienceinstitute.com. Sign up to receive weekly updates, leave a review on iTunes, and share this episode with your friends.